Welcome to Remainders, where we talk about the movies and lots of other fun stuff. I have a feeling today's episode is going to be packed to the gills with things that we can express about our last crazy, chaotic week in the world.
Oh, man. Love it. Welcome. My name is Patrick.
My name is Darren.
How's it going, bud? Good to see you.
Good to see you too. It's really great to meet up with you. This is our 30th episode today of Remainders, which I think is something we're celebrating. 30 episodes is, yeah, pretty great. I'm glad that we've kept it going this long, and we're at the end of the year. I'm not sure if we'll do another episode before the holidays or before 2023 goes out. I'm sure we'll discuss that, but this is a pretty good one to talk about. It's a movie that is, I think, most people have seen, so it'll be interesting for us to talk about it. I don't think we've done one this popular before.
Yeah, that's a good point, but I mean, it's definitely, you know, in my heart for sure. I mean, we've covered Tim Burton. I don't know if we said it, we're covering Edward Scissorhands today. We've done Ed Wood before, and so we definitely talked a good amount of Tim Burton. Definitely one of my favorite directors. I know a favorite of yours, so you know, it doesn't matter how big the movie is. We're going to take advantage for milestone episodes to talk about the ones we may not always get to talk about. So
I know definitely. It's kind of funny, though, because from my perspective, when we talked about doing this, I was like, oh, is it maybe like a cop out? Because like we've both seen this movie probably like 800 times before, you know, but it's not. There's so much to talk about in here. And I think the relevance of it, of course, you know, this movie being from like 1990,
yeah.
Yeah, 1990 and like all the way to 2022, a lot to discuss. And also just like this movie is brilliant and popular for a reason. And I'm sure everybody listening to this will attest to it being maybe one of the all-time greats. It's a classic at this point.
Oh yeah, completely agree. But we'll get to it in a little bit. It's got a few things to catch up on and check in, see how your week's going, what you've been getting up to. I want a 6 feet under update, by the way. I want to know what Nate's been doing in these episodes that you're watching right now.
Okay, so yeah, 6 feet under, definitely, you know, every weekend. So I don't really spend too much time watching this now with my lady. And we, on the weekends, we'll watch, like we'll binge as much as we can, because that's like our time to really shut off and shut the work off. And we've been very much enjoying 6 feet under, as our listeners, if you've listened to the last couple episodes, Pat and I love this show. 6 feet under, and I've been rewatching it with my girlfriend who hasn't seen it. So where I am is Nate, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert, but Nate, like, she just found out, because again, I get to see her reaction to this in real time. And there's that amazing scene where David has to like come out, and like, you know, we've got that episode where really, really, really ahead of its time, you know, talking about the gentleman who had passed away because he was targeted for being gay, and then they have funeral, and then that kind of sparks David to like coming out. But also very soon after that, we hear that Nate is giving the news to David. So much life and in the show, so many important moments. I would watch the show my whole life and just always get something out of it. And one thing that I think is cool living in California is they talk about these like locations that back when I watched it the first time living in Chicago, I would never know. And there's I always go to eat at this place called Fred's 62 here in Los Feliz. It's like our place kind of. And they mention it, Keith, David's boyfriend, or at this point they're on the rocks, but he tells him after church, he's like, hey, you want to go to Fred 62 in Los Feliz? We're going to go, you could come tag along. Back in the day, I would have never known. Now I'm there every weekend. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's good to hear that you're definitely enjoying the good LA food, because, I've been thinking about what a great food city Chicago is, and wonder whether or not you've been missing out on that. But
it takes money to be able to go to eat. That's the only thing. I'd go to all the places in LA a ton, but I just need to, like, you know, save up my cash first, because it's expensive out here.
So what is that? Is that the second season? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, we're into the second season now. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, I mean, I like these little updates. I feel like we shouldn't talk about it too much, because I feel like we definitely should cover That's in some way or form, you know.
Agreed.
I definitely want to get into the specifics of certainly each season, but I don't know if we can go to each episode, but that would be.
Look, I'm fine with changing the subject as long as we don't talk about Avatar.
I mean, give the people what they want, which is the update on Avatar.
Pat, yes. And I have a running joke that he loves Avatar and I don't necessarily love Avatar, but I think you saw it this weekend, yeah?
To be clear, I don't love Avatar. What I love is the event of James Cameron making a movie. So, okay. You know, I was pro Avatar for sure. But Cameron, for me, was such a huge influence. Arguably the person who is most responsible for me falling in love with film. I mean, how much did I watch Aliens, the original Terminator, Terminator 2 growing up? I mean, he was just an integral part of my childhood. So the fact that he has a new movie coming out, that's what I'm most excited for. So
I can get on board with that 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going wild for Avatar. The original one was good. I think it's a good movie. I think it gets a lot of shit because it's the most popular and it's easy to kind of build up hatred towards a movie that is on top because it's still the highest grossing movie of all time, technically.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. And that's the thing. It's it's not anybody still talks about Avatar since it came out 13 years ago. It's not it was a cultural milestone or anything like Star Wars, but again, it's James Cameron that I was most excited for. You know, I mean, Avatar, it's easy to forget. Avatar was his follow-up to Titanic. That's how few movies he makes. You know, whenever he makes a movie, he puts his, you know, his full dedication and time into it. So, he made a couple documentaries, obviously, but he was.
I saw the ones that he had made about the Titanic and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's kind of what he was doing, after Titanic, and then eventually came to Avatar. But again, you know, he's just such a blockbuster filmmaker that to have him kind of come back and try to make one of those, I'm all in. So yeah, I did see it last night and the preview night. We're talking on Friday, the actual opening day of the movie. But yeah, I had a fucking great time with it. I mean, again, he's fully dedicating himself to it. Like what he wants is 4 sequels. So his 10-year plan is for 5 Avatars overall. So the fact that he's all in on this in the latter part of his filmmaking career is kind of what is most awe-inspiring to me. And it was good. Like it definitely is a blockbuster in the sense that it's, I don't know. I don't want to say too much about it.
It's a big movie, right?
I mean, yeah, it's in the way of the Marvel universe now, but good, but actually thought about, but actually invested in, you know, and not to shit on Marvel, you know, I've watched a bunch of their movies and they're fine, but it feels like a MCU movie, but actually thought about and good. So
yeah, the Marvel movies I think are also timely, right? You know, let's get them out as soon as we can, because they're a big moneymaker. That's, you know.
Yeah. And then for Cameron, I mean, there's been 30 Marvel movies since that started, which actually started the same year as the original Avatar. So there's been 30 of those movies since Avatar. And now James Cameron's finally making a sequel to his movie. And it just shows the time that he's put into it. So again, it really is. I'm just so in on Cameron as a filmmaker and as a person that for a fact, you're not going to get his 100%. You know, even if it's even if you're ambivalent about the Avatar universe, which is, I totally get, but you can't say is that he's not fully invested in it. So
there's a friend of mine who worked on a show that he did about sci-fi, sci-fi greats on AMC. And he got a chance to interview James Cameron and George Lucas and a bunch of really crazy big directors in the sci-fi world. And he said when James Cameron came in there, he was like, all right, how much time we got? You know, looked at his watch and was like, knew like as soon as he sat down, what everybody in the room, who they were, what they were doing. And he said like the best way to describe it was that like he could have taken over any of their jobs. Like he could have done their job well, every single person in the room. And I'm like, yeah, like as if that's not intimidating,
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've seen a couple like short documentaries. I saw one on aliens. And every time you see anything behind the scenes, he is full on, like full hands on. Like he's constantly actually holding the camera. He's always engaged with like orchestrating everything behind the scenes. And I mean, it makes sense. I mean, he's definitely comes from a working class kind of Canadian neighborhood. He was a truck driver before he was a filmmaker. Like he was just always was fully hands-on in a very working class way. And whenever you hear him talk, he's a very down to earth, a little bit pompous, but like certainly down to earth guy who believes in himself. So.
Yeah. You've always been, I like hearing you talk about it because it's kind of making me, not that I don't think of Avatar like a real shot, but then again, I don't think I looked at it the way you talked about it. I don't think I even really, like, I've of course seen T2 Judgment Day like a million times, of course. I mean, and I love it, but you know, I don't even really think that I've looked at that from like a technical standpoint. Like it was so monumental for so many reasons because of all the technology and all the things that went into that film that it almost sort of overshadowed. That almost became like the topic of why you should like the movie, you know, because like it was so groundbreaking. And so you're not even really looking at the movie for any other reason than just like these sort of technical reasons, if that makes sense. And so maybe that's kind of what happened with Avatar for me. It's like it was that first one was so talked about like the kind of groundbreaking technology that was happening. And I was like, what for this universe, like you're going to put that much time and effort into it. That's kind of, I guess, maybe that's not a good way to think about it. But yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not going to go ahead and defend Avatar to really anybody. I mean, it is a pretty surface level story. The characters are pretty thin. It is really more about themes, I think, with it, and the themes of connectivity and the natural world and colonialism and the finite resources that our planet has. So it's like, that's what I think works best about it by far, is that that's the world that he's building. But yeah, I mean, I watched Terminator 2 last week to get prep for it. I mean, it's still like 100 times better of a movie than Avatar. So by no means am I going to fool myself into that. But
well, that's cool. I mean, hey, and like you went to the movies and had a good time. Like, isn't that what that's about?
And again, yeah, that goes back to it. It really does show all the how much recent blockbusters over the last 10, 15, 20 years are like lacking because they don't have the in-depth dedication that comes from a Cameron film. Again, it's like it's an experience, it's an event. Like, so even if it's like a subpar one for Cameron, you know, it's still substantially more fun than a lot of the other shit that we get in the theaters these days.
Well, it's interesting too, because like filmmakers like Scorsese or something, you know, like you make a Boxcar Bertha, or like, you know, his days of working with Roger Corman or something like that, where like, you know, they got no budget and they're just making them, and they're but he's still Scorsese. I mean, you know, he's great, except there's not a lot of money, and it's kind of like, you know, turn him around because they're his early films. There's still like something about him that it's like, damn, this guy is like, he's got something. Like he's above and beyond everybody else. And then that gives those directors the luxury as they get older to kind of have the final cut, as they say, or to command the story, or to take 15 years to make the movie they want to make, because these people are like above and beyond most filmmakers.
Oh yeah, no doubt. And it's, again, I mean, seeing an auteur work in a blockbuster fashion is just, you know, it's a rare thing these days. But we don't have to talk about Avatar all day. I mean, I definitely want to hear about your recent viewings.
Well, yeah, so that's where I was going to go. I was going to turn the conversation to The Fabelmans. Speaking of legendary directors, I know you've seen it. and I've seen it as well. Anybody in the audience who hasn't seen it, I think we would both recommend this film. Steven Spielberg doing something that's a little bit more personal. I think all of his films have been personal in some way or another. This one is just a little bit more overtly on the surface, very personal to him. It seems like for the most part, it's his story of him growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I gave my thoughts on it last time. I want to hear what you are taking from it.
So for me, I went and saw it over here at the Los Feliz 3, and you know, that's my music box right now until the Vista opens up, which is still closed. I think Tarantino's in there probably shooting a movie right now. I don't know. It's taking forever. But the Los Feliz 3 is a great theater. It's just so classic, you know, and they... we had such a nice movie going experience. Again, I mean, you know, knowing that it's like a Spielberg film, the audience was filled with like people that were older, which I liked, you know. It was kind of like, you get to hear kind of like what they're talking about, and people from the neighborhood, or, you know, their thoughts on filmmaking and stuff. And it was cool, you know, for that aspect, just like going to the movies. But then, you know, to see the movie, it's about the movies. It's about a love of cinema, but it's so much more, of course. The acting in it is really, really hard. I don't know. I think the Oscar nominations or the Golden Globes came out recently, and I think Paul Dano got snubbed, but Michelle Williams did get nominated if I'm remembering right. And Michelle Williams is probably one of the best, like on par, in my opinion, with like Gina Rowlands and like some of the Cassavetes films. I mean, her in Manchester by the Sea is one of my favorite performances by her, but this is above and beyond that even. And I'm really, really, really impressed with her performance. Everybody in there was good. I love Judd Hirsch coming in as like the kind of the crazy uncle. I like that, you know.
He cut through so perfectly as just like this is like a figure that comes in and out of your life at a young age who stays with you, you know. Yeah. Just like what they say and kind of what they representative, what they represent and their value of art. And that obviously was pretty influential on him when he was like a 13-year-old kid.
Yeah. And so I know, you know, we probably don't want to spoil too much here because it's a newer movie, but I will say that just like seeing these moments that are so devastating in this boy's life through the lens of the camera, which is the thing that excites him the most, is what almost makes him stop, you know, doing what he loves to do. And that can happen in your life, you know, where like something gets kind of, I don't know what the right word is here, but ruined and for lack of a better word, because of something that kind of tarnishes it, let's just say. And in this scenario, it's kind of like one thing after the other, and it's about perseverance in a lot of ways, because then they move and then he goes to the school where, you know, there's obviously racism and hatred. And it's kind of like, everything was really good. We had this great family life. Nothing was disrupted. I could do these movies. I was the hero. But life's not like that, right? Problems keep on coming and your life gets complicated. But like the love of the art and the thing that you love to do will always win. And then there's that amazing, I could probably go on for hours, so I'll probably stop here. But there's that amazing thing with Judd Hirsch where he talks about how art will rip you apart and it will, and it's like, so, you just, I can totally relate. I could totally relate.
Yeah. I mean, it really is, like I was mentioning in the last episode, like his experience with shedding light on his life and how conflicted he is with that. So we don't have to give too much away, but like there's a character that he films, and he films this character who he should have no reason to do so, but he films in a very positive light. And it plays well with the audience. It plays well with everybody. And you can see like his own inner turmoil with that, because that's what films are. Like they shed light on real life, but at the same time, it's a full fabrication. It isn't real life. And so like him like struggling with that, was one of the things that hit me. Like when I watched it, I was just like, this is.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that my girlfriend and I have discussed, like kind of in length, like that it didn't really compute to me right away, like what was happening there.
Okay.
Until I just kind of heard you say it. And I wouldn't have remembered last week because I hadn't seen the film. But that scene is very big part of the, it's a big part of the film. And that guy is really, really pissed. He's like, you know, why did you make me look like this hero when obviously I've been racist to you and, you know, shitty and, you know, beating you up? Why would you paint me in that light? A very interesting take on that. I'm glad.
Yeah. I mean, he was more confused than anything, for sure. And again, like they were both confused, like the Spielberg character, he's like, he's not sure why he did it. But like when you love movies, you understand that, you know, it's to put the, you know, it's to lift people up, you know, that's right. What film does, you know, for better or worse. And so, I mean, I love that scene. And then,
I know what you're,
yeah, asking. I'm not going to give too much away, because it just builds up to one of my favorite like climaxes in any Spielberg movie. It's just, it really is astounding, like how much of like a, you know, not down to earth or anything, but it is just this connected drama throughout this whole film. And then the last 5 minutes with the cameo of one of his heroes, it just blows everything away, and it fully transcends him into this life that he's still living to this day as a director.
Yeah, and let's not go there, because I feel like that's going to ruin.
Yeah. No.
Like, I'm glad you didn't tell me, kind of like, but when it came up, I was like, fuck yeah, fuck yeah, fuck yeah, fuck yeah. Like the whole time, it was like the best, you know?
Yeah. It's just a fantastic cameo performance at the end for one of Spielberg's heroes. And again, like I said, I think it was a movie I was really loving, and then that just put it over the top. It's going to be an all timer, I think, for Fablemans, like in his retrospective, I think it's going to be a top tier one.
I liked what you said too about that film standing the test of time and like really going to age well. I agree. I think it's going to be looked at as one of Spielberg's best films. And it's not surprising to me that it seemingly did not do well at the box office. I don't think a movie like that can nowadays. I mean,
yeah. I mean, who knows? I'm certainly not going to claim to profess. I understand the box office, certainly in the last couple of years because of obvious reasons with the pandemic, but like yeah, I mean, it's biography. I mean, it's biopic. Those are, you know, hard to succeed, especially when it's not like a prolific character. You know, he's a prolific director, but not necessarily like somebody that everybody wants to hear his life story, but unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, very cool. I'm glad those two movies had to get them out of the way. Babylon's opening soon, which I very, very much want to see, and I will. But yeah, I know it's been shown a few screenings in Chicago. My nephew who goes to Columbia actually got to see it already. And I've been trying to sneak into some here in LA, but they're all sold out. Like it's gonna be the popular movie of the year, I have a feeling. But you know, rightfully so, it's Damien Chazelle and Margot Robbie and fucking Brad Pitt, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely gonna try to get to that one this week. I had a pretty good week as I saw Avatar. I think I mentioned to you, I went to go see John Waters, his annual stand-up show, his stand-up Christmas performance.
Where at?
It was at the Avondale Music Hall, right next to Logan Square here in Chicago. Oh,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of newer venue, just outside Logan Square. And it's great. I mean, yeah. He is so, I've never seen him before live or anything. He's just like so on the top of his game, and so comfortable on stage. I mean, he was just, you know, talking to the audience for 2 hours straight. And it was just like very sharp with everything. It's incredible. I mean, his movies are great. You know, I was just thinking about Serial Mom actually a couple of weeks ago. I need to rewatch that one. That's a underrated one.
That's my favorite John Waters film.
That's your number one, really? Okay. I mean, that was certainly my first John Waters film that I ever saw. That was just like playing on when I was a kid.
Yeah, well, that's like a little more accessible for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like,
oh, definitely.
For kids, sure. Like, you know.
Yeah. And so, but it was great. I mean, he had a lot of good stuff.
I guess Crybaby maybe is the most accessible. Sorry. But yeah, close second would be Serial Mom, right?
Yeah, I think so. We had such a great time. Yeah, he definitely is keeping the filth as like a connector for humans. Because that's, I mean, really what he is all about these days is just kind of like tearing down the divide between so many people. And he's just still using his passion of filth as a way to do that. You know, we're all filthy to some degree, whether we like it or not. And he just loves exploring that. And he's got a new book out. And I haven't read it. I think it's his first novel, but I have not read it. I mean, he is a great writer. I've read Carsick and Role Models, which I highly recommend. Role Models, it's a collection of essays, where it's literally him just talking about the people who were most influential to him growing up and currently still. And he kind of got into it. And I mean, I don't know if you've heard, but he has been optioned for a screenplay and to direct Liar Mouth, which is his new novel. So it's going to be his first movie that he's directed in like 20 years, I think. Since really? A Dirty Shame, I think, was his last movie in 2004. And yeah, he's going to be doing the screenplay for his novel and then directing it. So
great.
He kind of got into that. So it was love to hear in that he's going to be getting back into the game. So
yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. Did I talk last week about going to see that Natalie Palamides thing out here? I can't remember.
You mentioned it briefly.
The Nate.
What was it?
The Nate play that I saw, like.
You didn't go into too much detail, but you brought it up quickly.
Did I tell you like who was in the audience by any chance? I can't remember this.
No, I don't think so. Who was it?
Okay, so my girlfriend and I like love going to this place called the Elysian Theater over here, and we've seen this entertainer named Natalie Palamides, and she's like really like blown up. I've talked about her before. She had that show called Nate on Netflix, and then we went and saw like her a couple times over there. But anyway, she was doing the Nate show, and my girlfriend just like was like, we got to see that in person. And she like totally fucks with the audience, you know, like where she wrestles people and shit on stage. It's crazy. And you're like hoping she doesn't pick on you, you know, like they call it clowning. It's like what they do. Anyway, we're sitting there, and as like that's about to start, like there's like a couple people that walk in, and it's fucking Evan Peters, man. Evan Peters sitting like a few seats away from us, like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, star of Dahmer this year, right next to us, and like number one most streamed series on Netflix actor. It was kind of like one of those whoa, like, you know, like because you're sitting there for like an hour and a half with like kind of like a nice like celebrity sighting that we're like, you're enjoying the same art in the same building. It's just kind of a cool feeling, you know?
Hell yeah. Yeah, that's great. I still have yet to watch Dahmer. He seems like a character actor that's just been hiding under, not hiding at all. Like he's just been great in a lot of stuff, but he didn't get like full appreciation until Dahmer.
I mean, he's a pretty serious actor, but he won an award for it actually in that Mayor of Easttown.
I've not seen that.
Yeah, it's an HBO show with Kate Winslet. He was in that. He is kind of like he's weirdly under the radar, but he's like really a serious actor. It's pretty great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, not. I kind of meant more like he's given a lot of good performances that people love, and yet he was not really a well-known name until Dahmer.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was looking at some of his stuff as IMDb. He definitely takes a lot of roles where he looks very different. And so that obviously poses a challenge.
And the Dahmer thing has been very controversial, obviously, for a lot of people, and you know, rightfully so. There's dealing with a serial killer and people's families and things like that. So it's been in the news for more than just being like a show that people enjoy, I guess.
I forget. Did you say have seen all of Dahmer?
Yeah. I have.
You have, yeah. And you liked it? Yeah.
I did. I, in my opinion, I thought it was very, I thought it did a very good job of actually paying tribute to the victims. But I'm not a victim of it myself, so I can't really speak on that. But just as a viewer, I got a lot out of how they treated the people that were targeted and passed away due to the serial killer. And, you know, it's something that the human in the human condition where we're like obsessed with things that can like harm us. And when you like, you know, I watch like horror movies all the time, you know, it's like, it's good,
good way to put it.
Yeah. It's good when you see it on TV, when it's not, when it can't hurt you. It's like, but it's something that like you're fearful of, you like the fear of it. And it's something that's scary. So it's interesting, but if it is close to home and it touched your life in somehow, like, I can't imagine the horror, like that's true horror, you know?
Hell yeah. Yeah, so that, I mean, the way you phrase that, that's a good way to put it. So,
yeah. Well, should we set? I mean, we've had a lot to talk about. And if you're still with us in the audience listening, thank you. I hope you enjoy when we talk about the things that we're into, because that it always has to do with the movies and things that will segue into what we're talking about, which is Tim Burton's 1990. I guess you could call this like romantic comedy slash Christmas movie, Ed Wood. I don't know. What would the genre be?
I mean, my first reaction of genre would have been drama. But I think what you phrased actually expands on that quite a bit more. But again, I mean, that's what's great about Tim Burton is that, you know, he's hard to, you can't put him in a box. That's certainly the thing. One of my favorite
there's directors. Horror in there, there's comedy, there's drama. It's like, wow, it's got everything, right?
That is a good point. Like rewatching this. So I probably haven't seen this in like, you know, at least 5 or 6 years, which is probably the longest that I had gone without watching it. But I forgot how funny it was, actually, especially Alan Arkin, who's like so perfectly cast in this movie.
Speaking of which, he has a little role in that Robert Downey Jr. Film Senior, which I watched on Netflix, which was excellent. Sorry for the aside there, but Alan Arkin kicks ass. Yeah.
I know. Like, because I remember, so I first saw this, I'm pretty sure I saw this in the theater as a little kid. I think it was one of those experiences where it was my family going to see a movie. And because we were a little too young, not for the subject or anything, but like we were just kind of impatient. I think we only I only saw like the first half of the movie, because I certainly don't remember like staying in the theater the whole time, but I definitely have vivid memories of like certain early scenes as a kid watching in the theater. And I remember you know, having those images of Alan Arkin, but then like to watch this as an adult to realize like what a legend this guy
was
at such a young age was always very entertaining. I mean, like he's just so perfectly captures the blissful ignorance of the suburbs.
It's funny that you bring up Alan Arkin, because it's actually like on this last watch, like what I enjoyed most about the film. And I guess like when you finally are able to take away from like how kick-ass like everything is about it, like you can like start to hone in on things that you didn't really kind of like appreciate that much before. And Alan Arkin, he could, because he's just so good, he just fits there. He kind of like is there to support, like you said, kind of suburban dad, you know?
Yeah.
But like as an actor, I mean, he is so on point in this movie.
No, he's hilarious. I mean, almost every line he comes out with is fantastic. I mean, like when he's first meeting Edward Scissorhands at the dinner scene, he's just like, must be a big change for you here, huh, Ed?
And yeah.
He just like, that's just like the tone that he maintains throughout the whole film. And like I said, this being a movie about Tim Burton being horrified by his upbringing in the suburbs, Alan Arkin kind of maintains not necessarily the positive side of it, but just pointing out, you know, just showing that there's nothing evil in the suburbs. It's just a lot of blissful ignorance. And that's what his character kind of captures. Cause there's so many, and we'll get into it, but like the mob scenes are just, I was cracking up watching the mob scenes in this movie. Like when Edward first shows up, all the housewives are calling each other and meeting each other on the corner just to get a glimpse of like this new person. They don't even know that he's anything special. He's just like, there's somebody new in the neighborhood. We got to gossip about it and talk about it. And then later in the film, when they're actually like creating a mob to get rid of him, it just I love how much it captures everything that he felt about the suburbs growing up in Burbank, California.
Yeah, the suburbs are, it's no mistake that it's a huge character in the film. I mean, every way the houses look, the fluorescence, the Avon calling that opened up the whole film with like her being the Avon lady.
Yeah. So
Diane Weiss, by the way, was awesome in so many Woody Allen films, but obviously in this as well. And she's had a great career in her own right. But also like a little Alan Arkin thing that I love is when he's talking about like the wallet and when it's, and it's like, you know, what would you do? Would you, A, you give it back? Take the money, you know, it's like so good the way that they do that. And it's always around the dinner table, right? It's like these like stupid conversations about like lessons to be learned. And yeah, Alan Arkin is so great at all of those things. And then I guess what you're going to do is you're going to go to the bank next. That's the next move, huh, Ed? You know, like, again, so suburbs, like, oh, you want to start your own business? Well, now you got to get a loan and you got to, you know, it's like a whole like, step, it's like a whole feudal system of the way to survive in the suburbs, you know.
If you want to acclimate, you got to put yourself in debt, and you're not quite set ready to get put yourself in debt for this, right? So
right,
I know that, yeah, anybody, is so good.
Yeah, oh, amazing. Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. If you're, you know, if you want to get yourself in debt, here's this, here's the quick access route, the
starter pack.
But for anybody who hasn't seen this film, which I'm probably not very many of you listening that hadn't seen it, but it is a film about an inventor at the so yeah, let's just be real, this is like the story of Frankenstein, really. Yeah. You know, and it's a modern telling of Frankenstein, a 90s telling of Frankenstein, really. And the inventor puts together this boy who is incomplete, but it's going, before the inventor can actually complete him, he passes away, which leaves him with these scissors for hands, which is just these mechanical things that were placeholders on his hands, which makes him obviously very scary, but it's played by Johnny Depp so well. So one of the first roles, I think people really were like, holy shit, this guy is like, you know, a chameleon and he can really act, you know. It's very silent film, his role in this. It's more about his expressions. He's so good in it. Watching this again, we can talk about Johnny Depp probably for like years about this movie, how good he is. But it's also something that, you know, you'd love to know about. It's like, he is this character of Edward who's unfinished and is very innocent because he's shut off from the world, and he's in this kind of castle above the suburban town. And when Diane Weiss comes to call on Avon, Avon calling to see if anybody's at the castle, she ends up coming across Edward, who she then brings down because she realizes he's on his own. And then what is this? Then the story kind of takes off from there of what does this outcast, this person who doesn't fit the mold of the classic suburban family, or the classic suburban family, you know, person, like it's like an upheaval for everybody in the town when he shows up, and then the story kind of takes on from there.
Upheaval is a perfect way to put it, because again, it is this cookie cutter neighborhood that, again, like, so Tim Burton, it's pretty clear this was his rebuke of growing up in a suburb similar to this. I think he grew up in Burbank, California. And yeah, I mean, I just had such a great time watching this. Now the older I get and the more, you know, I grew up in a suburb. I was more than happy to kind of get away from it when I grew up. And I mean, I love living in a busy city like Chicago. And I still have those vivid memories of the monotony and the sameness of everything in a suburb, where it's just a very boring, you know, I mean, I had a boring childhood, which in some ways I'm very grateful for, but at the same time, there's not a lot of stimulation because everything's the same. And again, this was his just his complete disdain for that and how uncomfortable that he felt growing up. I mean, he's definitely been very vocal about this in the past.
Well, there's again, this is very timely to talk about, because I was going for a walk yesterday. And here I am in Los Angeles. I can be whoever I want to be. Like, every time I go out, there's somebody that's different. I, you know, would walk around in the suburbs and I would wear like, you know, I don't know, a chain wallet. And all of a sudden I was like, ooh, that, you know, ooh. But like here, everybody can be who they want to be. You can look as crazy as you want to be and express yourself however you want to be. And it's very much accepted. And it's really a wonderful place. And it's a really a wonderful way to live, because I feel like everybody feels like they're unafraid to do that because they're not going to catch shit about it. The example, walking around the street the other day, there's a guy walking a fucking duck. I was walking a duck. I took a picture of it. I was like, dude, this is kick ass. He's walking a duck. Like, and I was like, you know, everyone's walking by this, like on their cell phones, like whatever. It's like normal. You know what I mean? And it's great to live in a place like that. At least for me, I like it.
No, I mean, it's the worst thing life could be is boring.
Yeah, right, right.
I don't know, that's what I say about movies. The worst thing a movie could be is boring. And yeah, I think that's, I got no time for a boring life. So,
but also to each their own, you know. So again,
for sure,
people that you know would probably say it's what do they call it? Like weird, like LA weird, or what do they call it? I can't know. Anyway, a lot of people say like LA weird. It is. It's like, but it's awesome that way for me. I think Edward Scissorhands is a great view of what it's like to be creative and compassionate and to be misunderstood, and have people that, you know, threaten that way of life. I mean, the bully played by Anthony Michael Hall is like a great example of it. You know, he uses him, right?
Yeah.
Use you to get into my parents' house and steal their money.
He's really great as a bully. Like that, this was probably, like I said, like seeing it at a young age, this was probably like the first movie I'd seen him in. So I hadn't seen him in like something like Vacation or Breakfast Club quite yet. And
Weird Science.
Such different characters. And yeah, sparring against Bill Paxton and Weird Science. He definitely plays a great bully because he's a real shithead in this movie.
Here's the funny thing about it is I feel like after this movie, he didn't really play anybody but a bully. He kind of fit that mold like after this to a T. It was like almost like he was too good at it, that he kind of got typecast that way.
I don't know too much about him, but I feel like there was something like as an actor, he was very much not interested in being perceived as a geek. With the movies that he was playing with, like, you know, Breakfast Club and Weird Science. Like, I feel like maybe as an actor, he had like a little chip on his shoulder where like, I'm tired of being looked at as a geek in Hollywood. So he kind of probably just went against that. And
gotcha. Well, like you said, he's great in this. I mean, he's very convincing, especially like the one scene where he's drinking in the back of the van and he's like, oh man, I feel like I'm going to pass out. He's like, later.
Drive me right now.
Get in the car.
Come on, man. Don't make me drive right now. Just do it. All right.
Yeah, he's so good.
And we saw him recently. I don't know if you rewatched it, but yeah, he plays the
Tommy Doyle. Yeah.
Tommy Doyle in Halloween Kills. And which I was happy to see him show up in that.
The middle film. Yeah.
They couldn't get Paul Rudd back to play him, so they got Anthony Michael Hall. So, and he definitely did a good job in that one, even though it's a pretty bonkers movie, though. So,
yeah, he gets it in the end, that's for sure.
Yeah, totally love it. I mean, I was just cracking up at so many of the suburban tropes, and the food was one of them. Like, I was just. There's so many scenes with like ridiculously
ambrosia plain. Salad.
I was just gonna say ambrosia is the most disgustingly suburban food I can buy. Totally. Like I kind of knew what it was, and I had to like Google it and to see exactly what it was. And I probably tasted this as a kid, and I'm so happy I never have had to eat it ever since. Because
like any kind of Jello mold,
oh god,
any marshmallows or any kind of fucking shit in there. Like
that scene when Joyce, the horny housewife, she's like feeding him that giant spoon of ambrosia. Oh, that's so bad.
The crazy thing about it is like you're saying, like everybody initially there's an upheaval because like there's this new person there, but everybody, like just like anybody in the suburbs, it's like a gossip factory. Like what's that great line in Pulp Fiction where it's like when you scamps get together, you're worse than a bunch of people in a sewing circle. I can't remember the line. Anyway, it's really good. Somebody out there is going to be like, you're an idiot. That's a classic line that Eno says. But anyway, like, it's everybody gossiping. They're on the phone, blah, blah, blah. But at first, it's like a good kind of like, ooh, the one girl likes Edward because he's different. And she like wants to like have a relationship with him. And everybody then all of a sudden realizes like he's kind of like a gifted artist and he can like cut my hair. And like, so everybody's getting this haircut, and there's like that great orgasmic scene with the one woman, and you know, she's like getting the haircut, and it's like, you know, moving her, and the dog's getting it, all the hedges are getting cut. So he's like the hero at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And he's kind of still at, like, either if he's the hero or the villain, he's still like not understanding, like he's still like doesn't fit in, and but he plays the role pretty much the same no matter what. It's like the people and how they react to him based on the circumstances that happen that change. He never changes, really, in my opinion. He's sort of just always Edward, you know?
No, that's a perfect way to put it. I was reading something about the writer talking about the movie, and she said she based the character on a dog. And apparently that's something that kind of like went as a through line, just this obedient, affectionate, totally open being. I definitely see it much more because I never heard that. But her basing it on a dog, her own pet dog, you could definitely just see like how genuine of a person Edward is. And it kind of comes through with that.
Yeah, for sure. And then... So like there's that great sort of, there's this new guy in town and we all love him and, you know, everything's really great for a couple of weeks until he starts to kind of get into some trouble. But really it's because, again, the way he's affected by being in the town and around the people that he's with. And so Anthony Michael Hall is like, you got to come and, you know, I know you can open doors with these scissor hands of yours. And he also knows that like, you might have like a crush on Winona Ryder, which we haven't talked about yet. Winona Ryder is amazing in this, of course. And he like uses him and manipulates him. And as he does, Edward starts to get into some trouble. And that's kind of the beginning of it, right?
I mean, this movie has one of my favorite scores in the Tim Burton, Danny Elfman combination. And it just captures so much of like how Edward feels about Winona Ryder's character. Like you just hear this score, just even like just a couple notes, and I just instantly feel like what he how he grows to his affection grows for over the course of the movie.
Yeah, because they never like make out or anything like that. It's not like
they hug at the end, and that's becomes one of the most meaningful events in his life.
The line that kills me every time, and she says, "Hold me," and he says, "I can't."
Yeah,
I fucking cry at that part. You know, like it's such a beautiful, like that relationship is very beautiful. Like it's like the love that you can't have. You know, like
it's a Christmas tree in the back. I don't think we were even really mentioned. This is our Christmas pick. So if we did mention it, it was just
no, we didn't. But that's like another. Okay. What genre is this? You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, this is officially our alternative Christmas choice. And yeah, like it's such like a perfect setting and for it. And then when they have that scene, then he creates the snow for her with the ice sculpture. I mean, it's definitely one of the most iconic shots in Tim Burton's career, I think, and certainly one of my favorites for sure.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing. If you do watch like Frankenstein back to back, there's a lot of like shots that are like kind of like, you know, them going up on that hill, especially with the mob mentality and everything like that, like and kind of trapping this person into the castle and not too sure what happened to him. Like, you know, not to get into the ending too quickly here, but you know, that's kind of the thing, is like the mob is only happy once like it gets what it wants, which is like the perpetrator to be finished with, you know. And the nice thing about Winona Ryder's character is like she is protective of him even though she knows they can't be together, and she starts to turn when the movie progresses and she realizes that like he didn't want any of this. You know, he's here and he's being asked to rob this house. So she's quite, and even like when they're doing that scene and they hug and they're holding, he sees out of the window that the little boy, I forget his name now, but he almost is going to get hit by a car by Anthony Michael Hall because they're driving drunk, and he goes and saves him. But when he's on top of him, he can't help it. He's just got these scissors for hands and he's like cutting him up, but he doesn't mean to. He's just trying to see if he's okay. And he's so misunderstood, but even Winona Ryder sees that and she knows he's not trying to hurt him. But by that point, it's all over. There's also like the issue with turning down the advances by the woman who like really wants to like sleep with him. And once he does that and this woman gets like turned down, now he's public enemy number one. And everybody starts to just like, it's like a snowball effect.
No, I mean, I was trying to think of a pun with snowball and Christmas, but or something didn't work. No, I mean that. I mean, everything he does is misunderstood. I mean, that's definitely the MO of the character coming from Tim Burton, and it's no surprise that this is the movie that he made after Batman when he could do whatever he wants. He's like, I have more power than I'll ever have in my career, and so this is the movie I'm going to make. And
so this is after Batman.
I mean, so
I thought Batman was 92.
No, that's Batman Returns.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, I mean, we may have mentioned this. We may have talked about his like debut like during Ed Wood, but like Tim Burton legit has the strongest debut of any director working. I mean, his first six movies, it's Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, and then Ed Wood. I mean, those are his first six feature films. Fucking crazy, right? Like that is an all-time debut for a director.
Here's the thing. He's such a great artist and he has such a unique mind. And he checks all the other boxes. He knows how to tell a story. He knows how to incorporate love. Like we don't even know how to like put what genre this is, you know? Like right. He knows how to like give it everything to everybody, but with like the extra creative like flair. Like you don't see a Tim Burton movie and not know it's not Tim Burton. It's so interesting and so different that it doesn't surprise me that all of those films have succeeded, because like the formula for making great films is there, all of the things that need to be there, but then the extra layer of the fact that he's just this creative genius, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the way he was able to parlay his artistic work that he was working on film, like in the art departments, and then just be able to translate that into behind the camera and being able to execute like his own visions. It's incredible. And obviously like he hit it really big with like Beetlejuice was like big. And then Batman was like at the time, like one of the biggest successes in Hollywood for years. And it just allowed him to like continue with like I said, leading on to this and Ed Wood, which, I mean, it's probably this and Ed Wood, I would say, are my two favorite Tim Burton movies. I mean, I love Batman for sure.
So do I. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, those are like top three. You know.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly the most Tim Burton movies, like the Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood. I'm so happy we've been able to cover both of them because they're so meaningful. But yeah, like I said, it was just like, it's pretty incredible, like how out of the, like how good his first six movies are, like just out of the gate, like just how proficient and confident he was to able to execute like what he saw in his mind.
And you know, there's like a thing with Tim Burton. I remember watching the Sleepy Hollow, what do they call that? With a track where he talks on it.
Commentary.
The commentary. I watched the Sleepy Hollow commentary, listened to the Sleepy Hollow commentary when I had that DVD back in the day. And I remember him talking about how he likes to set the tone over the credits in the beginning. You know, so if you remember in Sleepy Hollow, there's like a bunch of things happening where they like show like the logos and everything, but you've got that score going over the, you know, to set you in the mode, to get you like ready to go. And he does that so well with the title sequences in all of his films, but it's pretty special in Edward Scissorhands, where they're kind of showing this inventor's kind of Rube Goldberg, kind of like in Pee-wee, like, you know, how they have that whole setup of kind of these contraptions that are making these kind of things. And it again, it sets you in a gets you in a mood for what you're about to see, and entering you into a world which is Tim Burton's, you know, crazy universe.
Remind me, you said you saw Danny Elfman in concert recently?
I saw him at Coachella, and he did these scores, and it was.
Oh, he did. He performed some of these scores.
Yeah, it was. That was like the point. Like
he. Oh, okay.
He did a lot of his own music too, but like in between, he had an orchestra with him.
Nice. And
he fucking conduct the orchestra. I mean, did the Simpsons theme song. He did all of the Tim Burton stuff, and it was awesome, awesome, awesome to see. I'm lucky I got to see that.
Any Oingo Boingo songs?
Yeah, he did. Like
the hell yeah.
Yeah, he was definitely like, again, his greatest hit. And I remember him saying, he's like, I haven't been on stage and like, playing live in like something like 20 years or something crazy. It was like, whoa, like he it was kind of like a rare gift. He's on Epitaph. Danny Elfman is part of Epitaph Records. Huh? It's crazy.
Wow, that's awesome. I watched, his early stuff was just, we watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 last year, which is
Toby Hooper, right?
Yeah, Toby Hooper doing the second one as well, same as the first. And I love the sequel so much, but I completely forgot like the opening scene because the sequel is like so much.
Yeah, more, campier.
And that's part of the reason why I love it as much as the first one. But the first scene when Leatherface is attacking the two college kids, it's an Oingo Boingo song playing like throughout the whole scene because it's like the DJ cutting with the attack, and it's I think it's No One Lives Forever, but it's just like you can hear him singing it. I mean, it sounds like Jack Skellington, and it just the crazy tone of Oingo Boingo, it just like so captures that movie perfectly. I was loving it.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, and he did of course stuff from Nightmare Before Christmas as well. Yeah. And you know, when he does that voice, it's like so it's like that's Jack Skellington, you know, so cool. But that was great. And yeah, it should be said that so Howard Shore did the score for, they had like one film they didn't do together, and Howard Shore did Ed Wood. And I think Howard Shore did an awesome job with Ed Wood. I really love it. But that's the one film that Tim Burton didn't team up with Danny Elfman for, I think. I'm pretty sure it was the only one.
I didn't realize it was Howard Shore doing Ed Wood. So
yeah.
I mean, Tim Burton, his opening scenes are just top tier. I mean, combining like the tone with the music, and then just the visuals are always so perfectly over the top. And like you said, like in this one, when you're seeing the contraptions in the opening, sets it up so perfectly.
Yeah, you know, I really love what we're talking about this film. Like I said before, I was kind of like, oh, it's like a pretty popular movie. Maybe we shouldn't cover it. But then again, there's no rhyme or reason for this. It's just like movies and loving the discussion about them. And so we get to talk about Danny Elfman, we get to talk about Tim Burton, and I didn't even really realize how big of a character the suburbs played until we talked about it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is you can always get something out of films, even if it's like the most popular movie that you've seen 20 times. There's always something that they give, and I love that this film it gets me every time. When I watch the end, it's like a storybook, right? Like we talk about like it being kind of Frankenstein, but it's also very bookended with like Winona Ryder as the old lady at the end. And she said, you know, I don't really know exactly how. It's like such a nice bow to be put on this. And it's also so bittersweet. It's like those movies where it's like, you don't really get what you want, but it's still beautiful, right? Like you want them to be together. You want Edward Scissorhands to be with Winona Ryder's character, but they just can't be. It's like, that's the tale, you know, like forbidden love in a lot of ways. And when you see the fact that when it snows, she thinks that's, he's got to still be here because it never snowed before he came, before he came into the town. And so I just love that. It's such a nice bow. It's such like a perfect movie, like little nugget of good that you, why that you that, that like touches your heart, you know, and makes you want to watch this movie again and again, and probably what makes it the Christmas movie, right?
Oh, it's definitely one of my Christmas movies. But yeah, I mean, you definitely captured it there. I mean, a bittersweet fairy tale is like definitely kind of a way that I view it. Because yeah, it does have, I mean, a very melancholy love story. And that's a reason why it stuck with me, like ever since I saw it first as a kid. I mean, it does not end the way that you would think a love story would. And that's the reason why it resonates so well and is representative of Tim Burton in general. So,
and sometimes the idea of real life, like paralleling a little bit with these movies, I think it's always in people's minds when they watch this, that Johnny Depp and Winona Ryder were a couple at the time, or that they met, I think, on this film and then started dating. So I kind of love that too. You know, you can always be like, they liked each other then, or, you know, like, it's just that kind of nice, like, overlap that you have of the real life characters or the real life actors. And then the characters in the film kind of had this thing together.
Yeah. I feel like I knew that, but I definitely wasn't thinking about that at all until you just mentioned it, that they were together in real life. I don't know. Yeah, I kind of have like a thing, for as much as I love movies, it's like my mind does not retain the personal lives of a lot of celebrities. Not necessarily gossip, but like it just, I don't keep my ears open for a lot of it. But
yeah, that's an interesting way to be. It's different for me because I always like to like kind of be like, when I'm interested in some kind of like an artist or an actor or whatever, I'm always kind of like interested in their personal life too. But I like that you're not like that.
I think it's more particular to film and actors specifically. And it also might be just a rebuke that like there's so much celebrity culture, so much focus on people who aren't even celebrities that maybe I just kind of tune it out in my head. You know, because I was thinking the other day, it was like, there are like actors that I absolutely love, but I just don't know a whole lot about them, I guess. I don't know. It's
in that case, a person like you would be interesting. Like, so if there's some kind of scandal, it would be easy for you to separate that scandal from the artist because you're like, kind of interested in the work more so than you would be the real
life. Yeah, I mean, I think it also might be just subconsciously doing it because you don't want to ever meet your idols too much. Right. You don't want to know too much about them because it could taint your enjoyment of their work. And there's like so many examples of that in artists that I have liked. So I don't know, but yeah, I forgot that they were together. Actually, now I'm thinking, like, didn't he have a tattoo of Winona or something that he...
Well, yeah, so that's like the whole thing, is that he had one that said Winona forever, and then he changed it to Wino forever. And like,
that's right.
here's the interesting thing about
this. That's pretty funny.
It's pretty funny that he did that. And yeah. Up until like maybe she got on Stranger Things and like kicked so much fucking ass and like kind of had a comeback a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's like, oh yeah, Winona Ryder. Like, I love Winona Ryder. And then
a perfect role for her and TV show in general, just for her to come back on that. Yeah.
She's excellent in it. She's also a badass. I have a feeling that she like really controls the rights to like her likeness. Cause a lot of times you see like that thing is like plastered on every single merch item you could possibly think of. You rarely see her picture on any Stranger Things stuff. And I always talk about it with my girlfriend. I feel like she really controls her career and where she's seen. And I love that about her. I think she's a total badass. I love everything about Winona Ryder. And here's the thing about the Wino Forever thing. For a long time, I thought, that was so cool. Johnny Depp did that. Like, what a cool, like, fun, like, thing to do. Like, and poke fun at yourself. Like, if you have to remove a tattoo of the girlfriend you get in, right? But like recently I've been kind of like, no, Winona forever, you know, like that it kind of is like shitty to her, you know, like that they broke, but I don't think they did it for any malicious way. And again, this is talking about people's personal lives. I know nothing about, but I bought my girlfriend, she loves Winona Ryder too. And I bought her a sweatshirt a year and a half ago that said Winona forever.
Nice.
it kind of flip flop now. It's kind of like, no, Winona forever, you know?
Hell yeah, love it. Oh, it's got to be good. You guys must look good together walking down the street with the best fashion, film fashion going on.
Well, you know, like the funny thing about Johnny Depp is ever since I was young and saw him in films and saw him in movies like Edward Scissorhands, or he became Ed Wood, which of course I love, you know, Ed Wood and all that kind of B movie, Plan 9 from Outer Space and Vampira and all that. They just had her 100th birthday party over at Los Feliz 3, and they showed Ed Wood and they showed Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's like a double feature. And they had people from Vampira's family. Anyway, not to get too far off what I was talking about with Johnny Depp is that I always loved him, and I thought this is like the... This is what I would be as an actor. If I was an actor, I'd want to take on roles like this. I always thought that. I've always been a big fan of Johnny Depp, and I still am. And I think that those kind of actors are pretty rare, you know? Like, it just seemed like he was very interested in doing something interesting. And he kind of found his niche with, like, other interesting directors, like a Tim Burton, you know? Like, hey, you want to make this movie about this guy? He's kind of like more, he's not going to say much, and you're going to put a bunch of makeup on you, even though like Johnny Depp is like one of the most handsome guys in the world. It's like, but we're going to put a bunch of makeup on you and you're not going to be able to see you. And then he was game for that back in those days and stuff. That, like, that's a serious career move, you know? Like, that's a very deliberate role and like trajectory to take in your career, which for him, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, don't cover your face up. You're this, you know, teen heartthrob. And he just was interested in making the art. And that's what I like about Johnny Depp.
Sometimes you got to zag left, you go zag right with it. Yeah, he's crushing it. No, I love it. No, it's a really good point. When you, and you just got me thinking, not necessarily exactly about Johnny Depp, but kind of conceptually, like, as you mentioned, Ed Wood. Ed Wood was about the director Ed Wood teaming with one of his heroes, Bela Lugosi, and just the real life experience that Tim Burton had being able to cast Vincent Price.
Yeah,
in this movie, one of his movies, like, we may have mentioned this parallel, like, in the Ed Wood episode, but I mean, I just love that parallel, like, of what he was as an artist. You know, his hero, Vincent Price, he casts him, and then he goes on to make the very same story in Ed Wood about Ed Wood casting Bela Lugosi. And that's just such a perfect symbol for his interest in his career and who he was interested in, and then his own experience working with his idol. I love it.
I couldn't agree more. I also love the fact that this is Vincent Price's last movie. Like, what a way to go out, you know?
And I heard he would have been in it a little bit more, but he was getting sick by the time they were filming, so they kind of had to, like, you know, pull it back a little bit. And he ended
up, I didn't know. Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I, like, who knows, like, how big it was, but, like, I feel like there was just a little bit more limited than what he wanted. And I saw an interview with Vincent Price's daughters. She was saying just, like, how happy and ecstatic he was to be able to work with this young director that he was a fan of from his previous movies. And it was just like a perfect swan song for him. And unfortunately, he was just getting sick. I mean, he passed away like 3 years, I guess, after this movie, but it was, you know, like you said, his last performance. I mean, it's just it's incredible. I mean, I'm sure it's something that Tim Burton is very grateful for, looking back on.
Yeah, I can imagine. I have a Vincent Price autograph from a wax museum lobby card, and then there's like a Vincent Price autograph that I got. My mom's husband got that for me, and it's one of my prized possessions. It's really cool. I love it. It's framed up and stuff like that. I don't have it out here because, again, I have no room, but I can't wait to have a house one day and just have that on the wall. Like, I would stare at that lobby card all the time, just think about Vincent Price and how cool he was. Like, again, a very deliberate career path, you know, that he took. And that's why, look at this movie. You got Johnny Depp, Tim Burton, Vincent Price, all kind of like outcasts in their own right, making a go of it and being successful in Hollywood. I love that.
Oh, so good. So happy we got to revisit this one. So,
yeah, thanks a lot for discussing it with me. And I like that it's ties into the Christmas theme. I mean, we're approaching the holidays here, and I know what I used to love doing always would be the music box. It's Wonderful Life, where they'd have the carolers there at the theater. Do you do that at all?
Okay, so I went to the music box last Saturday. I went to see White Noise, Noah Baumbach's new movie with Adam Driver, based on a book I love that I read twice when I was younger, from Don DeLillo. Great novel. But they were having the shows going on, like It's a Wonderful Life. I think it was White Christmas was playing when I was there. Completely packed, like just fully, so like those shows still going, I think.
Yeah, they're always going on.
Yeah, those are extremely popular. I did not go to those. You know, I like those Christmas movies. We didn't really watch them too much as a kid. We were watching stuff like Tim Burton Batman on Christmas or something. Yeah. So but my God, going to that, it was half the audience were kids, the other half were the drunk parents taking their kids to see White Christmas.
Yeah.
I was like floored. It's just like the chaotic nature of having a child on Christmas and bringing them to the music. It was like, clearly it was like a lot of parents who were just like, this is my one time a year to get drunk, and because I'm taking my kids out and I got to deal with them all year. So I'm just going to fucking throw caution to the wind right now.
I can place myself in that room. I can definitely.
Oh my God. It was pretty insane. Like, I was like, hey man, have a good time. But like, oh my God, all these fucking kids running around and the drunk parents are just like,
A lot different than me going to see the Fablemans with a bunch of people that were in their 80s. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I like kids. The kids are great, but my God, I'm so happy I'm not a fucking parent. And it's kind of one of those times. Like, I knew at a young age that I did not want to have kids, and so.
Well, at some point, you know, when you see that, it is kind of like, oh shit! Like, you know, is that my everyday? Yeah. You know, I love kids and I want to have them, but like, yeah, sometimes when you see that, you're like, I don't know if I do.
Right. But no, so that was my long answer to say I had not gone to any of those music specials, but I know what a raucous time they are. So
yeah. Well, so that's like the fun thing is, like, you know, the audience kind of like will contribute and do the hissing when Potter's on, you know.
Yeah.
And I like that. My girlfriend even remembers doing that with her family. I didn't do it with my family so much. I did it with my drummer Tom. We would go every year. I just wondered if you were doing that. I don't know very many theaters that are that much more fun around the holidays, if you're a holiday, you know, Christmas person, than the musical. Yeah.
No, I mean, I've definitely talked about it to extensive length, but the horror marathons, those are the rowdy ones when everybody's getting up close and personal with all the characters that they've seen before. And those are that's definitely my preferred shows at the music box.
Talking about movie going experiences, like, you can't have a good time going to the movies, like, whether you just sit there and enjoy it or like you participate. Like, there's a lot going to the theater can do for you, so don't forget about that world, you know. Like, go see a movie every once in a while.
And it really was to continue with the theater talk a little bit, that's what a huge reason why I love theaters like the Music Box, and I'm sure why you love Los Feliz and all the other amazing ones in LA. It's the crowd. I mean, the crowd of the Music Box, everybody's there to see the movie, to really be engaged in the movie. And I mean, I went to see Avatar at an AMC, and it's definitely not the same experience. There's a lot of people who are just kind of there as like an excursion because they're just going to see a movie to kill time.
Like, the blockbuster, you know, mentality, like, this is going to be a big movie that everybody, like, it's action packed or something like that.
Right. And it just really makes me appreciate theaters like the Music Box, because like everybody who's going to the Music Box is really like engaged and just wants to be there because they love film. I'm always building more appreciation for that place all the time, so over the years, so love it.
Well, I think we're about ready to transition from Ed Wood, but I wanted to just say that I got to see that in Griffith Park at a drive-in. Edward Scissorhands.
Avatar?
Edward Scissorhands. It was a wonderful movie-going experience, too, because a lot of times the Cinespia out here that does them in the cemetery, they were doing drive-ins.
Yeah.
Got too cold to do them in Griffith Park. So you're literally in Griffith Park, kind of like around where the Greek Theater is, you know, and I told you it was really cold, like, out there. And there's that scene where Winona Ryder is, like, kind of dancing in the snow. And, like, just to see that, you could see L.A. in the background with, like, the, you know, all of the, like, in the distance. And you're on the mountain, and Winona Ryder is dancing in the snow. That's, like, seared in my memory as, like, one of my favorite movie-going experiences, just being, like, in a drive-in kind of in L.A. in Griffith Park, you know. So with that, I think, you know, this movie is something that if you haven't seen it, you need to go and watch it. You can pretty much stream it anywhere, a lot of places for free right now. But if you had seen it, go see it again and watch it, and take a look at Alan Arkin. You know, watch a portion of the movie that you didn't really pay attention to before, because there's a lot, as we've talked about, that you can enjoy on the third, fourth, fifth watch.
Big change for you, Ed, huh?
Yeah. So good. So we're going to transition to our picks of the song picks of the week.
We're keeping Christmas and the holidays. I mean, I don't really celebrate Christmas, but keeping the holidays going with our music songs. I mean, we have a bonus pick. I mean, I just want to say, like, Christmas Apology by T.O.B. My God, what a great fucking song. Man, nailing it as usual. Such a great song. Such a great addition to the holiday music list that I've got going on right now. So,
well, dude, I'll tell you what, like, that was put together so quickly. So for anybody out there who doesn't know, my band TLB just released a Christmas song. And we've tried to do that every year since we've been putting music out. So from 2018, we had a song called Black Christmas. And I was listening to that the other day. I was like, man, this is fucking dark. Like, like, there's so much, it's like black, like, it's not a blue Christmas. It, like, the take on, you know, Elvis's Blue Christmas. It's just like, it's not a blue Christmas, it's fucking black. And then we talk about, like, hanging ourselves on the tree and shit. Anyway, that's a pretty dark song. And then it transitioned to Christmas Spirits, which was about getting drunk on Christmas, and, like, you know, true TLB fashion, we're always talking about drinking. And then this one is based on a true story of getting an apology from somebody after not talking to them for a long time. So I was like, you know what, we gotta, like, it just, you know, sparked nothing bad. It was all a very good experience for me all around with this whole thing. But I kind of love that it always, just making art out of, like, things that happen in my life. And especially with TLB, we always, like, kind of, something happens to somebody, like, I had back surgery, I broke my back, you know, like, it's always some kind of a reason to kind of have fun and make a fun song. So Christmas, you know, this came up with everybody after something that happened to me, and I was like, dude, Christmas Apology, we got to have it come out. And Tom was, like, flying to Jakarta with the Plain White Tees, and, like, didn't have any time. He did the drums really quickly. I recorded the vocals and the bass right here where I'm sitting. And we, like, mashed it together in time. And it kind of opened up, like, a big, like, nice thing for us at the end of the year, where we're going to put out a new record next year. And then we're going to play a show. And it kind of all happened this week, where this stuff kind of rolled out because of the song. So it's cool. Like, I always feel like this band, we're always going to be doing music together. It's just too much fun not to. And there's always inspiration. It's always about breakups. It's always about drinking. And on Christmas, like, there's always, like, a fun way of finding to, like, a way to put the TLB spirit into a Christmas song. So thanks for listening. If you haven't listened to it yet, it's out there. It's called Christmas Apology. And yeah, like, it's a pretty good one, you know. I think
we're definitely going to put a link in the show notes, because it's definitely, like you're saying, it's becoming a holiday tradition that I think a lot of people are looking forward to each year, get a new banger from TLB to brighten up the end of the year. So like, it's in similar fashion.
I gotta say, okay, I don't know where we're going to go from this. I don't even know how to start talking about it. But before this episode aired here, Pat had sent me a link to his pick for the week. And I tell you, I had never heard this song before.
Okay, so I wasn't sure. I've
never seen the video before. And it absolutely blew my fucking mind. So you want to talk about your pick of the week? I mean, this is crazy.
Well, yeah, you definitely introed it well there. So yeah, I wasn't sure if you had ever heard it. I mean, my song of the week, this is an annual album, but especially this song for me is Must Be Santa by Bob Dylan. I'm finally recommending a Bob Dylan song.
Oh yeah, yeah.
One of my favorite musicians of all time. He's so ubiquitous in my life that I don't even really talk about him too much because, you know, I would just have too much to say. But he had a Christmas album out in 2009, Christmas in the Heart. You know, it's just an example of this artist who, you know, just expanded music for himself and for society for like decades. It's like, what do you do when you're an older man? You just make a Christmas album.
That's kind of why it's so funny. It's so out of place, yeah. Bob Dylan.
It's extremely out of place, and that's why I loved it. But yeah, Must Be Santa is a polka theme song that is just definitely one of my favorite songs on the album. And it's definitely one that I've listened to, you know, I go back to it every year on Christmas. For the first couple of years the album came out, this was on rotation at like every family party at my house. So we definitely had a lot of good memories listening to it. But the video, yeah, I definitely implore you to watch the video. We'll definitely put a link to the show because it is the most absurdist, over the top, unexpected type of shit you would get from Bob Dylan. And it just works so perfectly. This was a couple years before he received the Nobel Prize in Literature. So I think it actually had something to do with that, where this video just put him over the top for that award. Yeah. So I'm very, I wasn't sure if you'd heard it before or seen the video, and I'd love to hear that you got exposed to it and just enjoyed it.
Cause I know it's like kind of one of those things where I was rushing to get everything set up. Like I've been really busy trying to get things together for the, you know, the holidays, get some art out of the, to the post office. And I was walking back and you sent me that text. And I was like, I might have to push like the recording back just like a, you know, half an hour or something like that. And you're like, yeah, no problem. And I was like, okay, but I'll watch this before the episode. And it totally took me out of like this like frantic, like getting ready, like, you know, I'm crazy right now, to like just laughing and being like, man, it was like the perfect tone setter for this episode, because I was like, yeah, just relax and have fun. That's like what Bob Dylan is doing in this song, you know, just like he's just having fun.
Yeah. It's definitely a year-end staple for me. So I'm happy you enjoyed it. And hopefully anybody listening, if they've heard it, they know how over the top and great it is. And if they haven't, check it out, because you'll definitely see a new side of Dylan that maybe you're not familiar with. So
yeah, for sure. Well, cool. I like those picks. I obviously mine was going to be Christmas Apology. I think you knew that coming forward, but you know, there's like a lot of favorites from Christmas that I like.
I didn't know that, to be honest. That's why I was saying it was, that's why I called it a bonus pick, but, cause we had to get that in there either way. So.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, that'll be my pick of the week, just because I have been listening to it like literally nonstop for the last two weeks trying to get it ready. I mean, we had like a bunch of back and forth where there's just different things that were issues, you know, like tweaking, you know, the guitar part and blah, blah, blah. I kind of like what love how we recorded the song this time, because I'm in LA and everybody else is in Chicago right now. So to get it out in time to make sure it happened, I had to do my parts here. So I recorded the bass, I recorded my guitar, and I recorded my vocals here. But then after that happened, everybody like kind of got together back home, and I got to see like videos of them like, you know, singing on the song, and I couldn't be in the room. It was bittersweet because I love being with my guys, and even Dave Tirio was on it. He did some backup. So it was kind of cool, like to have everybody part of it, even though I'm out here and we can't. But for the record, because we have all the songs written for the new record, they just like, we've been writing them over the last 2 years. So we'll have like, and actually like probably record those out here in LA and Chicago, and I'll probably fly back for those. Cause like, you know, when we make a record, you like to be with everybody, but this experience was just a little different because we had to get it out quickly.
Well, man, definitely nailed it this time. So yeah, as usual, like I said, so yeah, love to hear it. Definitely a good addition to any year-end playlist. So
yeah, thanks. Hopefully it'll help with your Christmas running. I know like sometimes you like to have those playlists put together, and it's got a good pace, you know?
Oh yeah, I love it. Riding, running. So, I mean, I always got a TLB on the backup for that, those playlists. So
one last thing, sure. I got to plug before we leave, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And I did this for you, by the way. This is my Chicago art collection.
Oh, lineup. Okay. Love yeah. it. Yes.
So if you, if, even on the end here, that's Frank Lloyd Wright. So like,
obviously, oh, yeah. yep.
Oak Park, you know, heavy Oak Park vibes over here. And then obviously my WGN series that I did in July, was part of that Mind Rewind thing that I put together. And then our, you know, Empire Carpet guy, you know, this is my Chicago plethora. And I'm not sure like how well that will do, like if anybody will really get it, but I have an art show that I'm doing in person. My plan for the next year was my plan for this year. It just didn't happen that way. My plan for next year is to do a lot more in-person things. So a lot more off the internet and just really be in person with people. That's why TLB is going to be playing a show here in January. And then with this whole thing, I'm going to be doing more art shows. And on Sunday, I have my first one for Punk Rock and Paintbrushes. And so I've got all my art, like you can't see my place, but like it's all over the place. I'm trying to get ready for it. It's like inventory in it and stuff like that. So I'll be in person, if you're listening to this, selling art. If you need those last minute gifts, I'll be at Punk Rock and Paintbrushes in downtown LA. There's probably links everywhere, especially on my stuff. There's a flyer on my social media at Darren Burrell. You can just come check it out and get the address and come see me. It's a free event on Sunday, this Sunday, the 18th in downtown LA.
Hell yeah. I mean, my guess is that, I mean, every Chicagoan has 588-2300. In their heads, it's just whether they like it or not, you know, unless you weren't raised on a television, I think most people are our age. That was definitely a jingle that is ubiquitous in the mind.
Yeah, it's like Chicago. A brand or something on you. It's like you can't get rid of it, you know.
Whether you like it or not, that's a jingle that's inside your head if you grew up in Chicago. So I'd love to see the Chicago wine up there. That's fantastic. Always amazing work there.
Yep. So anyway, thanks for my quick plug. Anything else you got going on, or are we pretty good with wrapping up this episode?
No, I'm feeling good, man. Yeah, like we've been watching some good movies. Going to take a little time off the next couple of weeks. Just get a lot of good reading done. Maybe you know, lock myself away in a cabin. You know, get some good reading time and writing, and kind of unplug from the world. And then before we get back to it next year.
Good for you. I like hearing that. I like hearing about you taking care of yourself. That's really good.
Oh yeah. I mean, I love Chicago, but my God, you got to get out of it every once in a while. So to get a little bit away from the noise. So,
and well, maybe next season we'll cover something with Orson Welles. You know what I mean?
Okay. So this entire episode, I've been looking at kind of assuming that was Welles, but I wasn't entirely sure.
Isn't that a kick-ass shirt?
That is a fucking kick-ass shirt. That's
fantastic. Anybody who's listening, they're like, what are they talking about? But yeah, I'm wearing an Orson Welles shirt. So
we haven't
covered Orson Welles, right?
If you're listening and not watching, I mean, it's a very vampire-ish Orson Welles. It's actually got early Scissors vibes.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Artwork. It does, very yeah. much so. No, we have not covered Welles. And that's certainly a necessity, you know. Yep. We got our list going for next year, and definitely some good old ones, and maybe a little Fritz Lang. And I think Welles is going to have to get in that list as well. So,
yes, sir. And I think also RoboCop. Maybe we can finally give everybody what they've been waiting for, and it's Patrick, one of Patrick's favorite films of all time. We got to cover RoboCop next year.
I mean, the great American film is inevitable. For this podcast, so you know.
Oh, by the way, last thing I gotta say, I'm sitting there at the post at UPS. I should have texted you. I was sitting there at UPS, and there's somebody's got a fucking awesome playlist going. I don't know, somebody at the counter was busy as hell, and I'm sitting there, and the Nick Cave theme song for Assassination of Robert Ford by the Coward, or Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, the fucking theme song is going. I'm like, somebody gets it hard in here, you know, like somebody just really understands shit. It was great.
Hell yeah. I actually, total coincidence, I actually just ordered the novel that was based on, which I have never read. It's supposed to be a great book, and so
yeah, you gotta let me know because I love that film. You know, we should cover that too. Yeah,
definitely, we'll get that Nick Cave cameo at the end in that movie. So yeah, we can appreciate it a lot more now that we've talked about it.
I mean, we've talked about that film like in between things for sure, but we never really like talked about like actually did the episode on it. So maybe we'll put that up in the list.
Oh, it's definitely gonna come at some point. So yeah. Definitely excited for it.
All right, man. Well, hey, if I don't talk to you, happy holidays. Happy holidays, everybody out there listening. Thanks for an amazing year allowing us to do this and talk movies. We love to hear from you guys. If you have any thoughts or comments, I know our old friend Don has been commenting on our YouTube page, and we actually are up to 20 subscribers on YouTube. So, I mean, that's a big deal for me because we were like at like 9 a couple weeks ago or something, so.
Hell yeah. Well, I definitely appreciate every 21 of those. So yeah, thank you for listening. And yeah, happy holidays to you. Happy holidays to everyone listening. More than happy to keep on talking all of our favorite films. So
yep, absolutely. So we'll see you in 2023. Talk to you guys soon. Have a good rest of the year. Bye.